Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Hi there, it's Joe here. As the name suggests, this is our Martin O'Neill interview. I'm sure you'll have seen he's been doing a few sit-downs lately with different journalists and outlining how he sees things, so it was great to get some time with him. Just a note, this was recorded last Friday, so it was before all the Declan Rice business emerged, so there is no Declan Rice chat here, thankfully, or otherwise. So I'm sure you've seen what he's had to say about that in the last few days. We met him at his office in Abbottstown, and he gave us way more time than was promised. And as you'll hear, we do get onto the football eventually, and he gives, I think, a very passionate and confident defence of the job he's done. First, though, given that it was rare enough to actually sit down with him in this kind of environment, we wanted to get a feel for him as a person and where he is at this stage of his life. With that in mind, I started by pointing out it was heading into All-Ireland Football Final Week, and 2018 being the 60th anniversary of the 1958 All-Ireland Final between Dublin and Derry. Dublin won, O'Neill was 6 years old, and he was there to watch his brother play for Derry.
Yeah, I was. Derry and Dublin, of course. I had my older brother, who was older, I said he was 18, I think, at the time, playing in the All-Ireland Final. He had played in the semi-final against Kerry, and I think he was, I know he was sub in the game against Dublin. I think it was a disappointment he hadn't started in the match, but anyway, didn't deter my mother and I from travelling up to the game. My father, who had helped form the Gaelic club in Kilray at the time, he was away with some of his friends, so was left with mother and I to travel up together. A long, long journey. Left about 5 o'clock in the morning. So, but certainly worth it in terms of an experience.
Yeah, I'd imagine so. I've seen you speak before. You picked up people along the way. There were two girls with brilliant singing voices, and like, what a lovely sense of community there, kind of singing the journey away.
I think they sang the whole journey through as well too. I think we stopped off somewhere, I think around about Cookstown in County Tyrone for Mass as well too. So, but each county that we would go through, they would have the song for that particular county. And so that I remember. They were in great voice throughout the journey, and honestly they were missed because I don't remember travelling back with them.
Is it a vivid memory? At six?
Certain parts of it, I must admit, you know, early part in the morning when it was, we left Kilray very early, about 5 o'clock, and it was still kind of dark at that time. And so, you know, within the next hour and a half where it starts to get light, that I do remember. Obviously the girls singing the songs. I remember us being dropped off by the bus driver, and within a second or two people seemed to have gone their separate ways, so my mother and I were left to cross over the canal down that way, and find it was to the Nally stand, I think, that we ended up having our seats there, or as it turns out, one seat. So I had to, when the other gentleman came over and sat down beside us, he was from Dublin at the time, I had to move and sit on my mother's knee.
Yeah.
So, but anyway,
there's about 40 minutes of it on YouTube, actually.
So
if you want to jog your memory, I was looking this morning.
You're not serious, are you?
Yeah.
That'd be fantastic.
If you put in Dublin Derry 1958, you'll see.
And about 40 minutes of it.
Yeah, it's about 40 minutes of the video, so you'll get the highlights and you'll get.
That is fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it was wedged. I mean, the stadium was throbbing. It was full.
Absolutely. Yeah. Honestly, we were. It was a great experience. You know.
It looked like it. Yeah. The other thing which made me want to bring it up with you, so 60 years, wow, what a surreal thing, is you stopped for Mass. I know you'd mentioned that before. The Pope's about to arrive. We're talking on Friday. Were you religious? Have you been religious? Are you religious?
Oh, well, I think that, I grew up in the Catholic family, my mother and father, mother in particular, obviously, as a typical Irish Catholic mother, had us going to Mass very early on. And at Christmas time, I remember having to celebrate three Masses in the one morning. So, we'd be saying the rosary every night as well too.
Right.
So, and sometimes when later on in my career, I'd be praying for all sorts of things from God, particularly for results in matches, and when they didn't all come my direction, then I started to wonder whether there was a God or not. But I am joking, you know. So, We grew up as a Catholic family, and headed off to Mass every Sunday, and I seem to find myself in confession every other week as well too. But there we go.
So you have kept it, like that's remained a part of your life.
It's remained a part of my life, yes, of course, and I have a couple of daughters as well too, who have their own take in life, like everything else. But listen, we'll go there another time.
Okay, fair enough. To think back to, you know, 60 years ago, is it a kind of strange, surreal thing suddenly to find yourself at that age where the years have gone by so quickly, or?
And it will happen to you, young man. I'm telling you,
I'm already slightly queasy that I can remember things 20 years ago.
Is that right?
It's starting to happen to me.
You certainly don't look old enough, and if the camera could swing around a wee bit and see you, you're fine at this moment. It does fly in, I must admit. And I do remember distinctly that when I came to Nottingham Forest as a 19-year-old, I remember walking down the River Trent, and I was with the youth team manager, lovely gentleman called Bert Johnson. And he said, and it was within 4 weeks of me being there at the club, late 1971. Mm-hmm. And he said, this will pass you in a flash. And he said, he was talking about the career, sure. You know, a 10 or 12, 14 year career if you can. And it did. I must admit, it did. I just remember him saying that at the time, and I thought, I don't know what you're talking about, you know. Yeah. He said, trust me, it will pass in a flash.
It's the great cliche. Every young person's heard that line.
Absolutely.
And suddenly it happens.
Absolutely.
Has anything surprised you about, and by the way, this is not me rudely trying to hint that you're this old person or anything, but has anything about the aging process, or, you know, like they say, sometimes the years get faster, the older you get, has anything surprised you or struck you about life in the last 20, 30 years getting to this age?
No, I think I hear those words of Bob Dylan's song, you know, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. And that's how I feel, not at all. I'm even though I can't believe that the years have passed in, I don't feel like that, you know. I think your health is obviously very, very important, of course. And having experienced that in my own family with my wife and things that you see here, then health becomes the most important aspect of your life, seriously.
Yeah.
And while you don't feel that when you're probably your age, it's certainly very, very important. And more important than anything, I think.
Yeah. I saw you jog to the toilet there a few minutes ago, so I can vouch you're still moving.
I'm still in reasonable shape. I saw I had a recent reunion with some of my old Nottingham Forest colleagues, players who were brilliant footballers then that you would hardly recognise now, you know, rather corpulent, you know, a couple of them pretty rotund. And you
felt okay,
but you know what, I didn't feel so bad.
I didn't
feel so bad. One or two actually in still good shape as well too, but mostly not fantastic.
And are you disciplined? Do you watch what you eat? Do you exercise?
I wouldn't have done an exercise in 30 years, you know. I don't, you know.
Do you not miss the endorphins?
I did. When I was a player, we managed successfully to win the European Cup without actually doing a lot of weight training. Yeah. I was lower body, you know, I was very, very strong then. Upper arms, I always felt as if I had enough without being overly bulked up. But when you see the players now, some of the players in professional football, and then you see the rugby players, then you feel as if you must have been really, really weak at that time. But that's not how I felt.
Yeah.
And I'm not boasting about not having done exercises for some time. I didn't do weights or anything like that. That's probably what I meant to say. And
but you wouldn't go for a run now or ache to do any of that stuff.
I did my cruciate ligament, which was the career-ending injury, and because of that, I never got it fixed properly, and because of that, then I have a few aches and pains down in my knee. Obviously, a bit of a concern, But I'm still okay. I'm fine, and some people have asked me, you know, how have you stayed in reasonable condition? Mm. I said, well, I just worry for everyone, you know. So
no doubt.
That's it. But I'm fine. I would need to, obviously, as you get a bit older, need to go for a few more checkups and things like this here. But generally speaking, I'm not too bad.
And when you get to that point in life where you're going for checkups and starting to think about, you know, your health in broad terms, has football's place in your life changed? Like, does it diminish? Do you start making a bucket list and think, do you know what? We're kind of, I've done enough in the game and I want to do X, Y, and Z with my family? Or is it as central as ever?
I think it's as central as ever. I think that it's interesting you make that point. And I thought that the international football would give me the time to do that sort of bucket list that you're talking about. And because, you know, while you're watching a lot of football matches, you are watching particular players. You're not looking at the end result of a particular game, other than you don't want the players that you'll be picking in the following weeks to be smashed in the game and confidence is low. But I thought it would give you the time to do it, and it hasn't materialised.
Why not? Where are these gaps?
While international football does give you that time to ruminate, and it gives you either good or bad, you know, if you get a really good result, let's say at the end of November, Christmas is terrific. If it's not, as in the case of Denmark, then Christmas is poor, I must admit. But that's not the point. It's just you mentioned is football central, and maybe it's because it's still central to my life then that I haven't made the time for myself to do the things that I wanted to do.
Okay. Because, I mean, I know you're a huge music fan and you've quoted Dylan. I thought you'd be at every concert going and trying to take in all the...
Well, like, funny enough, you say that. I can still do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, I am. But you mentioned Bob Dylan. I saw him at Thomond Park some years ago. I must admit, and I wish I hadn't gone, you know.
Was he not in great form?
He wasn't great, you know.
Hit or miss with Bob.
Oh, I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to realise that the song he was singing for the previous 6 minutes was Lay Lady Lay. And I thought, well, it's not great for you, Bob.
Right.
But however, never considered him a great, great singer anyway. In terms of a songwriter, you know, absolutely fantastic. And the songs that people have taken, for instance, the Birds have taken Mr. Tambourine Man. Mm. And all the songs that if you're talking about great Jimi Hendrix, you know, taking songs from Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan actually liking the versions that other people have done of his songs. Listen, he's still up there anyway with people, regardless of whether he doesn't have a note in his head now or not.
Who are your 2, 3, 4 always go-to bands or artists?
Oh, well, that's a good point. No, I'm showing my age now. Of course, before I did the 11 plus, I think that would be I was listening to songs from Buddy Holly. You know, then obviously there was a craze just before the Beatles. You know, you had Cliff Richard, you had Marty Wilde, Billy Fury, people like this. Then along came the Beatles and the Stones. Then my favourite band around that time were probably the Kinks. Then you went to I heard the Birds doing Mr. Tambourine Man in 65, which is just fantastic, blew me away, it was great.
Mm.
Then The Who, of course, then Small Faces, maybe my favourite band of all. Then I go to school, I'm obviously at school, I'm at college. Then I go, my family move up to Belfast, I'm in day school, and then one day I was listening to some of the boys playing Jethro Tull. I thought, yeah, I really like that. And then I, you know, I would say that early Fleetwood Mac, with Peter Green, absolutely fantastic to me for. And I would say Free, Paul Rodgers, Paul Kossoff. Yeah, do you want me to go any further?
No, it's clear. This is a big part of your life. You're into this.
Leonard Skinner.
Yeah.
Just as good a band as there was. No, so yeah, absolutely.
What's on this bucket list when you do sit down and have good intentions that you haven't met? Like, is there one or two things that you actually think, you know, I really should do that?
I think it was traveling. I think I'd really wanted to travel. I wanted to do, I'd really probably wanted to go around North America. Mm-hmm. You know, in one of those big what do you call them?
Oh, like the camper van things.
Yeah,
yeah, but they're big. They do them properly over
there.
Fairly
that there. Yeah. But then sometimes we used to make comforts, so I thought maybe I'd just park that up and go to the hotel at night. And so then I felt, well, that's not really doing it properly if that's the case. South America appeals to me greatly. Yeah. My daughter came back from Buenos Aires a couple of years ago and said it's just extraordinary. And of course, I want to do that. I was lucky enough to go to Rio during the World Cup, but outside Rio, I've not been there. So I didn't go to Sao Paulo, and there's other places in Brazil I'd like to see as well too. And for some unknown reason, I want to go to Chile and Santiago. You know, I want to go down there. So lots of things still to do.
Yeah, okay.
Believe it or not, but and even traveling east, I went to Japan for the final of the World Cup in 2002. Always felt like to go back again. I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and this is where you have a think about this at your age now. Okay, I went to with Nottingham Forest. We went on a pre-season tour of a number of places. We went to Toronto. We ended up in Vancouver, down to Miami, then to Bogota in Colombia, and then back home again. And all. But anyway, we were in Toronto, and there was a journey to go to Niagara Falls. And some of the lads were playing cards at the back of the seat. And so Niagara Falls, you can hear Niagara Falls before you can see it. It's right. That rumbling, and it's fantastic. I think one or two of the lads still play cards and hardly get out of the bus. I made it myself, don't worry about that. Always thinking, don't worry, I'll see this again, because Nottingham Forest were successful and we were traveling all over Europe.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing places that, you know, I think I'll be there again. Well, I've never been to Niagara Falls since. So I'm delighted I got off the bus to see it, you know, to actually witness it there. So thinking to myself, you know what, in 2 years' time I'll be there again.
It's a good job you didn't have a full house. You know, who knows? Would you
absolutely. I think it was because, yes, it's absolute. I think the game we were playing was three-card brag and it packed in with a pair of twos or something, whatever it may be. But anyway, so there we are.
This is territory. Please don't go anywhere you're not comfortable going. But you mentioned your wife being ill, and I was just reading you opened, or you were.
I shouldn't have mentioned that. So
territory you don't want to go near. That's totally fine.
That's all right. Okay. Yeah. You know, it's everybody in this life has some problems or other that they have to overcome.
Yeah.
That's what I find out. You know?
Okay.
Everybody.
My question was less about her, and don't answer this if you don't want to, but you talked about it at a hospital recently, and you talked about it was a difficult time naturally. I was going to ask if it has changed you in any way, or is that too cliched a thing? Or do you revert to who you were before something like that strikes you?
I'll give you a quick answer to that. Do you know what? You think you're changing and you revert.
Hmm.
You go back.
Yeah. You did that speech at the Auras on Irishness, and I'm sure you've been asked about this before, so we don't have to dwell on it overly, but the great line from it, I thought, was where you said that you were full of anomalies and ironies and paradoxes and downright contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a mix. Probably too short a question and too big an answer for the time we have, because I do want to talk to you about football, but...
Oh, don't even worry about it. Listen, football, wouldn't even go there.
The anomalies, the paradoxes, the contradictions. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've probably observed some from afar, but what jumps to mind when you make that point about yourself?
I'm not really sure. For instance, right, I'll touch on the footballing side. We had a very charismatic manager in Brian Clough, I wasn't always his best friend. Far from it. I ended up earning a lot of grudging respect from him, because my early days with him weren't that fantastic. But the truth is this here, that there is a photograph. It's really interesting. Brian Clough's first ever game was for Nottingham Forest as a manager in 1975, was a replayed cup game at White Hart Lane, and we were only in what is called the old second division at the time.
Yeah.
There's a photograph after we beat Tottenham Hotspur at Tottenham, and would you believe this? I saw the photograph recently, and I hadn't seen him for a long, long time. And it's him celebrating in the dressing room, looking all round. And he brought me into the squad. I'd been left out by the previous manager, you know, arguing that I should have been in the team. But he brought me down, played me in the opening game. And you know what? I'm actually the only player in that photograph that ended up winning the European Cup with him.
With him?
Yeah. Well, we brought some young people down. Young Tony Woodcock was like a gopher for a couple of days. John Robertson, who was a world-class player, was injured at the time. But in that particular photograph of the team, so for all the criticism I heave upon myself and that there, you know, it's nice to know that I stayed with it. And there was a player called Barry Butlin at the time that had experience with Brian Clough at that time. And he almost vicariously had ended up was living a life at Nottingham Forest when Brian Clough arrived.
Yeah.
And I remember Barry Butlin, who didn't stay that long at the club afterwards because Brian didn't really think he was a fantastic player. I remember him saying that I asked him, what did you think he was like? And he said, oh, phenomenal manager. He said, if you stay the course, it'll be worth it.
Mm.
So I kind of felt, you know, with the second European Cup, I'd stayed the course. You know. So from that viewpoint, the point you wanted to talk about, the contradictions, I always felt that Clough could say something to you on a Monday, totally contradict himself on a Friday afternoon, and I'd believe both of them.
Mm.
You know, so I kind of believe my own contradictions, if that's the case.
In an interview just before Euro 2016, you said to Paul Kimmage that football was a great life in many ways, but stopped you using your brain.
Mm.
Were you talking about reading? Were you talking about thinking? Yeah. Were you talking about something else?
I was probably thinking about... I'd like to see that line again, if that's the case. But yeah, I felt that... I stopped reading. I stopped doing those things that I was studying law at Queen's University. I'd been there for a short period of time. I went... This opportunity now came to become a professional footballer at Nottingham Forest. I didn't know whether it was going to last a week, a fortnight, or a year. And I went back to the head of law, the law department, asked him, hey, listen, if things didn't work out, could I come back? And he said, absolutely, you can come back. And so fast forward a couple of years, tough times, you know. I'm hoping that I'm George Best at this stage, you know, and it's not happening at club level. I'm doing okay, but okay is not great.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, well, do you know what I'll do? Instead of going back to Queen's, I'll go and have a look at I'll have a look now to see what I can do at Nottingham University. And I actually got set up where they could give me courses outside my time as a footballer. They really went to great lengths to help me out, and I thought that I'll start using my brain again and start going and start and do this. And then Brian Clough arrived and her whole life changed, and I thought, well, listen, not for one minute did I think that Brian Clough arriving in January 1975 meant European Cup finals in 1979 and 1980, but I thought we're going to be in a bit of a journey here now. And so I didn't do that, and as a consequence, you stop reading, you stop and then when you are I loved spelling. I was really, really good. And then when I found myself going to the dictionary to look at spellings of words that I would have known when I was 11 or 12 or 13, that was disconcerting at the time, just for a while. But I mean, I'm not making it out as if it was a major problem.
Yeah.
But that's, and I think that was the point. And I think you stopped doing those. Whereas if I had been bright enough, I realised I could have done both anyway.
Of course. Have you rediscovered it? Are you a voracious reader again?
I'm back reading again. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
What do you like?
I'm.
You're not still stuck in true crime, are you?
To a certain extent, I have a bit of that there. I've tried to move on, but but I would be fact rather than fiction,
okay,
believe it or not. You know, although having said this, Thomas Hardy may still be my favourite author.
Because I know you grip by all these, you know, serial podcasts and West Cork. Are you into podcasts and all the true crime genre?
No. You're talking about having to really exist in this world, as my daughters tell me, get into the real world, Dad. These are the things that I need to improve on.
Okay.
Greatly.
Okay.
Really improve
so
on.
So you need to catch up on the trends.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. I worked in the assumption, which is not a great assumption, that if I wait from a Monday to a Friday, what was new on Monday will be old on Friday, and I think there'll be a certain Friday I'll catch up with it all. It just hasn't worked out that way.
Well, they say flares are coming back into fashion, so I mean,
do you know what? That would be amazing. That would be the complete turnaround for me.
You're coming up on your 50th 5-0 game with Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
5 years.
50 with that? You mean competitive and
yeah,
and
yeah, all in 50
and all in
yeah,
and all
yeah,
in.
Yeah, yeah, you're okay, coming up on 5-0, yeah. 5 years. Yeah. Maybe just sum up how you feel you've done. You know more about what you've done than anyone. Are you happy with how you've performed and delivered and how it's gone?
Well, I do you know what? I think that for instance, I come in with what I wanted to do overall was qualify for competitions. That's my main that's my main job, to try and do that. And you're dealing with a type of player that you want. Unfortunately, I came in at the time when Robbie Keane or natural great goal scorer was at the was you know probably in the winter of his career rather than the autumn of it, and so you're trying to look around for a goal scorer. The qualification for the Euros was terrific. You know, the trials and tribulations of getting there and the place, the winning of out in Georgia in the opening game. I'm trying to run through the games, but very briefly, the draw in Germany and Gelsenkirchen, great. The disappointment of losing to Scotland. You know, the setback that caused, considering it happened in November, and then you've got the Christmas time to think about it. The fight back then, the draw against Scotland in Dublin, where you felt as if, well, it's going to be difficult, but I never felt that. I knew that Scotland still had to go to Georgia. The Germany game, which was really fantastic to beat the world champions. The following matches against Bosnia. The experience in France, to me, was everything that I thought it might be with the Irish fans, mm-hmm. and possibly even more. Mm-hmm. Having seen from a distance before, watching the Irish fans enjoying themselves at tournaments, not all the time, because the Republic haven't qualified, remarkably, have not qualified for every competition. But to see that and to experience that and to be part of that there, I thought was fantastic. That's why I wanted to try and replicate it for the World Cup, even up a notch again, being the big competition. So the disappointment of losing out in that to Denmark, started off being fourth seeds, ending up being in the qualification, but to lose that, disappointment greater than feeling the euphoria of having qualified for the Euros. I think that's natural. It's natural with me anyway, and I think it might be with other managers, where you tend to brood over your defeat rather than be delighted. So overall, the players that we have, it's nice to see some of the players do so brilliantly in the Euros. Now it's up to them to try and emulate, if not try and surpass, that sort of form. Mm. And we've got the Euros now coming up. So you may ask me the question then, I think, maybe in the next 18 months.
Yeah, the next 18 months define kind of the two in a way.
Yeah.
So can I throw the perceived or general criticisms at you in a way where I don't want you to feel on the defensive. I want to get the logic of stuff that is said about you. That's why it's great to get to talk to you. So, and you know, the Wales, Germany, Austria, Bosnia, Italy results. So clearly this stuff works some of the time as well as not, you know. So I appreciate that.
Well,
so some common themes which would be discussed: training ground, there's a sense there's a lack of attention to detail as such. There's a more hands-off approach, maybe a Cloughian type approach, that's the way you operate. Is that fair, and what's your logic on that, your reasoning?
Well, my reason fun enough, I was asked a question today, why do you announce the team just an hour before kickoff?
I was going to come to that.
All right, okay. Announce it. Well, I've always done that for a start, you know, and aside, I did that the night that we played in the UEFA Cup final for Celtic against Porto, who went on to win the Champions League the following year. There is a difference. There is a difference in the sense that there's two things that are really important here. And it's really simple. Brian Clough is a great, great manager. Fine. Alex Ferguson, one of the great managers of all time. Alex Ferguson he was there at training all the time. He didn't interfere at different stages. I know he was dealing with world-class players, but he hadn't got world-class players available to the moment he walked into Manchester United. And he had time, he needed time to build up. But you're talking at club level now for a start. And that you are, that's really important. First of all, you have to do your job. But before you do your job, you have to know your job. And if you could ask any player that has played with me at club level, ask any and even players that I fell out with, there would be one or two. I think they know what their job was. Mm. I think they knew what their job was, and then it's a matter of doing it. So, if you're talking about somebody not knowing the side, there's a fairly decent chance that at least 8 of the players will know that they're going to be playing for a start. It's a fairly decent chance that 8 of the players will know their position. It's a fairly decent chance that 8 of the players will know what is expected of them. And one or two players who might not know, I may have told them the night before that they're playing anyway in the game. Mm-hmm. So,
the logic? Why do you hold off? Why say it's 7 o'clock the night before, let them have a chat amongst themselves?
Because not every single player, not every player wants that. Some players like to, some players who were told they're going to play in a game the night before might not sleep at the end of it all. Mm. George Best, the very first time he's ever played, Matt Busby, considered a reasonably good manager, I think maybe one of the best. Matt Busby talking to a little genius who turned out to be a genius, but his opening game, didn't tell him until an hour before kickoff, travelled with him, I think it was against West Bromwich Albion. So you're playing in the game. So he didn't know him intimately in that sense.
Sure.
And thought he didn't want to have a sleepless night. Mm. So there, I noticed that publicly I think that Gareth Southgate, who had a terrific tournament with England, announced the first side a couple of days beforehand. He soon realised he wasn't going to do that all the time,
Yeah.
So, but the players would fairly. I know there was one or two that we as pundits or people were mulling over us whether he would start with. I mean, Raheem Sterling or something. Sure. I guess here at the end of the day, but he would have. I'm quite sure he would have had a word with Raheem Sterling beforehand and said, "Listen, you're playing, but we're not announcing the tie till later on."
Yeah.
So those sort of things can happen. I've known managers announce the side, a complete day in advance. Hasn't made any difference to the results,
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's good to get you hear your thoughts on that.
No, it's important. It is important.
Because I think people might wonder about it, wonder what the logic is.
What happens is that regardless, you turned around and said, well, sometimes it seems to work and sometimes it doesn't. I don't think I would have been a manager for the length of time that I've been a manager without it, it wouldn't just occasionally work.
Yeah.
I know, and I hate to sound as if I'm the defensive, but I think my record in management would kind of sort of speak for itself,
Sure.
To feel that announcing a side or not, if I thought that winning a football game, and generally speaking, when I'm managing the Republic of Ireland, we are actually fighting against players who are technically better than us. So I've been doing that there for a number of years. So I would say that if I thought that announcing the side the night before would win us football matches, I'd announce it the night before.
Agreed.
If I thought that a player would change his dietary requirements from cornflakes to eating a large slice of bacon would change his mind or change his ability, I'd do it. I'd do it.
And on the training ground, is it fair to say you're hands off? Like various former players, and not necessarily in a critical way, but they have said things like, corner routines or just, there's an element of like your good players go out and play. That might be.
I know, I've seen that so often.
And I've seen it from former players of yours.
I've seen it so often. I saw a little Craig Bellamy once saying, and he meant it actually in a compliment when he came down to Celtic and he played with me at Celtic and he said, that we hadn't practiced the corner kick or something like this here. And yet we probably scored more goals from corners than anybody else. Do you know what I expected? And this is a point. And I don't want to sound as if this is a Cluffyism or something. I expect that when we get a corner kick, I expect the player to be able to deliver a really telling ball. And I expect players who I know that are very, very good in the air to come and try and head the ball and possibly head it in or keep it alive at the back post and that we can score goals from it. And at Leicester City, we did... Matty Elliott knew what to do.
And sorry,
scored two goals in a final. We won a League Cup, by the way.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say. So, I hear you. Like, I mean, there's lots of things that should happen. But I wonder when you watch, say, for instance, Gareth Southgate's England at the World Cup. You mentioned Southgate, and there's routines, and there's, you know, we're not blessed with a Robbie Keane, as you rightly said, and that's, you know, a crucial point. But is there an element of times where actually we might need to try and take better advantage of set pieces and do a bit more and come up with some quirky ideas in the training ground?
Of course, absolutely. And when you have the time to do that, it's great. I'd like to know, I don't know what the record would be here at this minute, but remember, when you have qualified for a competition, you have then now, in the lead up to it, you have a number of weeks. Yeah. At the end of the season, the players finish. That's why we did so well in the Euros. I had 3 weeks in which to work with the players. I'd have to say that in the Euros, I thought that we were splendid against Sweden and should have won the game. Well beaten against Belgium, who could have easily won the World Cup. Brilliant against Italy. And if we had a couple of more days rest against France, we might have forced a side who's ended up winning the World Cup.
And played very good football now, against the French.
And played really good football. There's a difference here. And I think that this is important to say to you. There's a ferocious difference between tournament football, being there, and actually trying to get there.
The trudge of Serbia
and
away.
And trying
on
to get there. Two totally different things. As if the players can throw off the shackles. Now, getting back to the point about there's only a certain length of time. I'm surprised that intelligent people, like yourself and really people who would even think about the game, would actually maybe stand back and analyse how much time someone has. You know, for instance, you know, we've got the Wales game coming up on Thursday. We've got players playing on Sunday. Their normal routine would be not to train on a Monday at club level. So if we continue that routine, so we've got players, Burnley are actually playing on the Sunday. So we have a number of players, Burnley, and we'll play. So they'll come to us on Monday, but they wouldn't train on Monday. Tuesday, we've got Tuesday before we fly to on Tuesday to Wales for a game on the Thursday night. Well, it stands to sense that you wouldn't have time to do all the particular things, but you will have when you get a couple of weeks to work with them. Again, getting back to the point, it'd be interesting to see the number of goals that England scored with set pieces in qualification. As in contrast to 9 out of 12 that they scored in the competition.
I will come back to that point at the end of qualifying and say, we'll see what the stats are, and it will be interesting to see. Yeah. I guess one last kind of broad point, because you've been really good with your time here, is, look, if we want to do medals on the table here, I think you're going to beat me quite handsomely. Mm. So, but just my observations. At times, I struggle to see the pattern of play or sometimes what we're trying to do. And I appreciate Serbia away is a different prospect to other teams, and sometimes games take on a life of their own. But are we at a point where if Seamus Coleman has the ball, we all know what we're about, or we know what we're trying to do? Because sometimes I just don't see the pattern. You'll see a long ball and you won't see runners off the front man, and you wonder, is everyone on the same page here? Or do you want Coleman to go short, first of all? Is that his first option?
What do you mean short?
Well, I'd ball into midfield or try and keep possession almost, as opposed to clip one and try and get runners around. So sometimes I don't see a definite pattern or get a sense that everybody is playing to that pattern. And I guess tied in with that, and I'll shut up now, but there's certain games like, say, Cardiff away, where there's a real sense that the team is pressing the opposition on the ball. There's a real energy about them to go after them and you know, almost Klopp-esque or Bielsa-esque, you know, that's their DNA. They always play like that. And sometimes we do the Cardiff performance, and then other times, are we trying to press them today, or are we not? And there's a disparity there at times. What's the pattern? If you were to say to people, when we go into the Aviva tomorrow, say, what are we going to see? I feel that there's been a disparity there. Is that a fair criticism? Why does that happen?
Well, first of all, I think that if you, you have to try and play to the team's strengths. You have to find out what their strengths are for a start. And I mean, I have as the assistant manager Roy Keane there, who you would consider one of the finest players to don an Irish shirt, never mind, and basically ran Manchester United for about a decade.
Yeah.
Playing with top quality players, he said that when he maybe go forward, in the last couple of years he didn't do, he'd always maybe Scholes to sit back or when Scholes would go forward, so players knew what they were doing. When he went stepped into the international arena, he had some decent players alongside, but because of the, you know, they were trying to develop a pattern during the course of matches. Now that doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a set plan, and our plan should, our plan has always been to, number one, you've got to try and be comfortable with the ball. Number, that's important, particularly when you're under pressure. Now, with respect, you and I could go out, we could play against Wales tomorrow if we felt that the Welsh would not close you down or not take the ball off you and press you. That's the sign of a good player, to be able to deal with the ball under pressure. And the higher up you're playing, the chances are the better the player you are for a start. But secondly than that, that's number one, particularly in middle of the field. Be able to deal with the ball. Even if somebody gives you a poor ball, you're still able to deal with it. As my old manager would say, then you can talk to him later on about it. Secondly, you're talking about your pattern of play. What you want to have is options for players. If we have it wide, for instance, let's say James McLean has it wide on the left-hand side and puts his foot in the ball 10 yards inside the opposition half. He has to, he should have, he should, and the thing that you're trying to work for, he should have three options. He should be able to look up and say, can I take this player on for a start? Am I capable of doing that? Secondly, if I'm not, and I think he's got me covered here, he should be able to look into the edge of the penalty area and see the centre forward shaping up for the ball. To be able to play into him, I've said to him, the safest place in the world for a centre-forward is to control the ball with a player at his back inside the penalty area, because he's not going to be tackled. And we want, and that's, or the third option is to be able to look for a midfield player so he can play the ball sideways so we can go and go around the game. Those are what we try and do.
If we haven't
been able to achieve that, well, of course, that is a problem. But that's what we're trying to do. And we try not to play aimless balls up the field. But every single time that we've cleared a danger, it looks like an aimless ball because it has gone to, it's gone to a player. I watched the game on Wednesday night, which three of my prospective players who could be playing in the game. I'm talking about Norwich and Preston. And, you know, it wasn't good.
It happens in games.
It wasn't good. Yeah. The game wasn't good. If you talked about aimless balls being played and the crowd become, they become disenchanted and they become just frustrated, I think, as much as anything else. So, but we have tried, when you said about playing about in the Euros, when some players came alive and did really well and enhanced their reputations and hence getting good money moves on the strength of it, namely young Brady and Hendrick. In an ideal world, it'd be nice to be able to play like that all the time. We have been unable to do that, yet we've gone very, very close to qualifying. Very close, and we were four seeds. So it feels as if I'm defending myself, but at the end of the day, it's important to know that one, know your job for a start, then do the job. I think the players know their job.
Okay, so you're saying the players do know their job, that of course they do.
The players know what, what's expected of them to do their jobs. And if, and I shouldn't even be having these particular conversations, but if you tell me that this is the general impression, I would quite sure that every single player playing for Joe Smith now at this minute would know his job.
Inside out.
Now,
and I would say, if you were to ask the average sports fan, perception-wise, there'd be a real sense that Joe Schmidt is detail, 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 almost to a fault. Like the players are on their laptops all night trying to catch up with stuff.
Ireland have also, let me tell you, Irish rugby players, you would have to say at this minute, outside New Zealand, Ireland maybe even be the second best side in the world.
They are, certainly, and best right. coached, arguably, as well, whereas the sense mightn't be there with the football. A silly example, but one that strikes me, okay. or, you know, people have made it. You must watch, and she's Roy must watch as well, ball might go into an Irish midfielder, the first touch is back towards the fullback who might have just given it to him, and everyone's under pressure suddenly, and it's back to the fullback and have to go long.
I've just explained to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this what you want? This is the sign of a top-class midfield player.
Is to get turned.
To be able to get turned.
And so do you feel maybe we don't have the tools to do that realistically?
Get turned. And then you have to ask, like, well, if players are not getting turned, you want to find out what division they're playing in at the end of it all. Mm. You have to find out. Which is seriously. It's a serious point. Why you have to find out what division they're playing in.
And are we seeing Premier League? We're seeing Premier League midfielders doing that on occasion for Ireland, I would argue.
The point about it is, first of all, when it's played into you, then the one thing I was taught as a midfield player, and I was an attacking midfield player, although I played wide right hand side for a lot of my time under Brian Clough. But eventually, it's one to receive the ball. If you know that it's coming to you, you have to have a picture in your mind about what's happening. Mm. And if the only option for you is to play it back, just to retain possession, that's fine.
Sure.
But if you've taken an age to control it, and all those options are closed to you, then it becomes more difficult. And it happens to the best of the players. But the very, very best players extricate themselves from that little trouble and generally play the correct ball into players. That's why we are lucky enough at this minute to watch Premier League football, where you've got some of the best players playing in world football at your disposal and watching, and you're expecting them, when it's played up to them, to be able to control the ball. This is very, very important.
Yeah.
Because you'll not be able to move too far if you can't control the ball. Mm. You know. So the idea about, again, it's getting back to the point. I don't think that you have to stop every single minute of a 25-minute game to go and prove that you're into every last detail. Mm. And there's a difference. There is a difference because there is a big difference in our games. I think American football, for instance, I'm a big fan of, is the game that a coach has a massive influence on, because this game, it stops.
Yeah.
It stops all the time. In fairness, rugby stops.
It's a set-piece game.
It's become a set-piece game. So players, when you talk about players now, excuse my rugby terms, you know, at the end of the day, Joe Smith will laugh at me if he's saying, but when there's a scrum, the players playing out wide know what's going to happen at the end of the day. It's a set moves that you know, and when Johnny Sexton gets it or whatever the case may be, there's a fair idea that the players know, because it's stopped, they're ready, and they can time to remember as well. But in terms of the set pieces, for us, I think you can be more innovative if that's the case. And the longer that you have working with players, that I think that you have that time. But if you're talking about trying to get everything right to beat opposition that are technically better than you in 2 days, I think you'd have to have another look at it.
That's a fair point. The very last point then is, you're clearly enthused by this and you're raring to go again, and you know, you've been out meeting the media over the last few days and keen to get that message out there. From November through to kind of January, and then suddenly you're getting phone calls from Stoke, and that gives you pause for thought. And did it waver for, like, were you thinking?
I think there's first of all, there are a number of things. I think the offers that were coming in, it wasn't the only one that came in, was the job that I was actually doing here, whereas it seemed to be the complete opposite, that everything was down to being beaten by Denmark at the end of it all. But I think that people who would want you at club level were looking at, one, your career for a start, and two, what you'd done at club level with Aston Villa or something like this here, but more recently, defying the odds here with the national side and qualifying for France, and actually doing fine in that. And actually, people who did, in fact, in one of the interviews that I was asked about, saying that, you know, you were four seeds and coming in the second, genuinely actually happened. So people were looking at it from a totally different perspective.
Yeah.
And so I think that some of the things that, again, I get back down to, did I mention to you about the the youth team coach who walked down with me and said it's gone in a flash. Remember I said that? The same gentleman, Bert Johnson, also said to me, I remember him saying, he said, if you get a reputation for being an early riser, you can lie all day. Mm-hmm. And that's never a truer word. So you pick up a reputation at the end of the day or something, it gets here, somebody throws something at you, and it sticks because the people want it to stick, and they want to throw it at you. I'm not re-enthusing myself, because enthusiasm is something I have in abundance. It's what keeps me going. It's important. You said football's still central to my life. Absolutely. All of those things are very, very important to me. And at the end of it all, if I want to go, I could, in terms of coaching, personally speaking, I think there was a distinction between managing and coaching a way back for some time. People said, he's a manager, but he couldn't coach, or somebody's a really good coach, but he couldn't step up to be a manager. I think there's some element of that. Some people do like coaching and can't manage. But Brian Clough was considered a manager and never a coach. Brian Clough coached points during the course of matches to us that stood the test of time. How about players closing players down? Things I'd never heard of. And I'd been involved in professional football as a player for maybe 3 years before he arrived. Mm. Brian Clough didn't spend every single day out in the coaching thing. We didn't practice a corner kick. We won 2 European Cups. And I think if he's up there, you know, Brian might actually be down below. But at the end of it all, I think he'll think, you know, did reasonably well. He's one of the great managers of all time. He was also a brilliant coach.
Yeah.
A brilliant coach. And he did not spend every single day on the training ground coaching it. But he coached important points during the course of the games, the times that you would remember. And he reinforced them all the time. And he did say, if you don't pick up this point after 3 or 4 times, he said, well, either you're thick or I'll get rid of you. You just can't do it.
Yeah. And last one then. What swung it for you?
It's been the last one for the last seven questions.
I'm sorry, I know. It's dreadful.
I've enjoyed it, funnily enough. I meant enjoyed my time as the manager here. You asked me how do I feel about it. Let's see if we can qualify for the next competition. It would be terrific. I just kind of remind you that the Republic of Ireland do not qualify every single time for competitions, hence the great euphoria around Jack Charlton.
Totally.
Doing
it. If I could magic you up Roy Keane and Robbie Keane and Duff in their prime, I mean, we would all do it. I think everybody understands. How difficult the job is.
No, I don't. I think that is the whole point. In essence, I don't. I think that there is an expectation, which I don't mind. I think there's an expectation that because I'm managing the side, that we should automatically get through, and that Roy's the assistant, that we should automatically get through. And therefore, if you don't do, then it's then you know you've let everybody down. And that is the whole point. And I think then people then will turn around and say, well, he doesn't do this. And then you find out that you have some fella that's been left out of the team reporting, you know, we didn't do this or we didn't do that for the couple of days that we had. And the next thing you know, that's it. Again, getting back to the reputation.
Yeah.
Sir Clive Woodward once said to me, he said, it was amazing how good a coach I was when I had all the best players available to me. You know, it does help.
I appreciate that.
It does help.
I was going to finish with, when it boiled down to it, and everybody, we're all adults here, a Premier League job with Stoke is tempting, and then continuing with Ireland, tempting. What swung it for you? Was there a deciding factor?
I wanted to, John Delaney and the board were very persuasive, thought that, take the setback from the game. Obviously a real disappointment. Take some time to think about it, of course, like everything else, but want you to continue. And I suppose deep down at the end of it all, I probably do you want your last match in charge of Ireland to be, you know, a really dispiriting second half performance against Denmark, and hence your World Cup disappearing. I think that's it. So, and I, as I said to you, my enthusiasm has always been there.
Yeah.
Might have to look at certain things, and a point that maybe you didn't mention. I think that when you have been beaten in a game, I think you tend to look at things very, very closely. I think you can tend to overanalyze, tend to maybe look at and see if your preparation has been correct, if that's the case. And there's certain things I think, yeah, do you know what? If someone I respect points out something to me, I think, you know what? I'll have a little look at that and see. And I think that's the best way for me to try and learn.
Okay. Thanks for your time and the very best of luck over the next couple of years.
Thank you very much indeed.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.